World War II. It's known as the Greatest Generation. And these are their stories. It's the World War II Project. Here are your hosts, Americhicks Molly Vogt and Kim Munson.
Well, hello, everybody. This is the Americhicks World War II Project. I'm Molly Vogt.
And I'm Kim Munson.
We love interviewing our World War II veterans. We want to make sure that future generations understand what took place in the Second World War. And there were so many different places that we were fighting, different techniques, different ideas, different weapons. And so we love hearing these stories. Check out the Americhicks website because we've got all of our former shows on there. We've interviewed over 100 World War II veterans, and we know that a lot of people are listening to these to teach their kids about the Second World War. So check out AmeriChicks.com. Also follow us on Facebook and Twitter for some live videos.
For sure. And this show really precipitated from a trip that Molly and I took in 2016 with a group from the Denver Police Activities League. We accompanied four D-Day veterans back to Normandy. And it truly changed our lives, standing on Omaha Beach with some of the guys that had been there with the landing crafts. We just really realized that we stand on the shoulders of giants, and it is such an honor to get to interview these guys.
It sure is. So today we are honored to have Harold Engel on with us. Harold, welcome to the Americhicks Show.
Thank you.
Thank you. Harold, do you mind telling us what branch and unit you were a part of in the Second World War?
Well, I was assigned to the 28th Infantry Division as a replacement. I was not with the division when they first went overseas. I joined them during the Battle of the Bulge.
Great. Okay. And Harold, when and where were you born?
I was born in Chambersburg. I'm a lifelong resident of Chambersburg, Pennsylvania.
All right. Great. Now, tell us, when you were assigned at the 28th Infantry Division as a replacement, what was it that got you to join the Army?
I didn't get that.
I said, what was the determining factor of you joining the Army?
I was inducted.
Okay.
I was drafted.
That'll do it, won't it?
Yeah.
All right. Yeah.
All right. Harold, do you remember where you were when Pearl Harbor was bombed?
Well, I was at home. That happened on a Sunday. And I had been home for the weekend because I was going to a business school called Pierce Business School of Administration in Philadelphia, and I was at home at that time, and that's when I first knew about Pearl Harbor, of course, on the radio.
Okay. Harold, were you surprised, or did you expect that the United States would enter the war?
No, I never expected that, but it all made sense. My father and mother took me and my brother on a trip to the West Coast in 1940. And that was when I finished my junior year of high school. And as we were driving down the Pacific Coast into Los Angeles Harbor area, we noticed these huge piles of scrap iron. And it went for miles down through the harbor area. Just huge piles of scrap iron. And my father was so inquisitive, he had to drive in and find out, where is all this scrap iron going to? And they said, to Japan. Well, then, of course, it made sense. You know, they were taking our scrap iron and making
weapons, huh?
Arms out of it. So, war equipment.
That is astounding. I'd never heard that before.
Me neither.
And that was in 1940.
That was in 1940. Yes. So my mother and father and my younger brother, we took a six-week trip to the West Coast.
And then it was in 1941 when Pearl Harbor was bombed, not even
two years later.
Wow.
So they were taking this scrap iron over to Japan by the shiploads.
Wow.
Huh. So it hasn't been the first time that we've helped the enemy, huh?
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Right.
So you were a junior in high school in 1940. When did you go into the Army, Harold?
Well, I had been deferred. After I graduated from high school, I went to Pierce Business College in Philadelphia in the fall of 1941. And, of course, Pearl Harbor happened December the 7th of 1941. But I was still in the business school, and I graduated. I took a one-year course, graduated in June of 1942. And the purpose of my going to business school was to help my father, who was in a business called the poultry and egg business. And he bought and sold poultry and eggs. He bought from the farmer and then sold them into metropolitan areas like Baltimore, Washington, Philadelphia, New York. And he needed help. So he was able to get me deferred about twice after I had graduated from Pierce Business School. But the third time he asked for a deferment, they said no more deferments for your son. So I had I was drafted into the service on July the 3rd, 1944. Okay. And from there, well, this was at New Cumberland, Pennsylvania, is where I was drafted. Since it was the day before holiday, July 4th, nothing happened on July 4th. But the next morning, on July 5th, I was on a troop train headed for Camp Walters, Texas, for my infantry training. Now, that was all sort of news to me, because when they stamped my papers at New Cumberland, they stamped my paperwork U.S. Navy. I was supposed to go on into the Navy. But instead, I landed on a troop train for Texas on July the 5th. And I ended up there taking my basic training there.
Do you now? So that was July 3rd of 44. That was about a month after D-Day. Tell us what you know about D-Day. What had you heard about D-Day?
Well, of course, we had to be listening to the radio, and we read the newspapers, and that's how I would have known at that time. Radio and newspaper. So I had a brother who already enlisted, and so an older brother that he enlisted in 1942, soon after Pearl Harbor had happened.
So was that your only sibling?
Now, I had a younger brother, and I had an older sister at that time. There were four of us in the family, besides my mother and father.
So your family had two boys in the service then. Did your brother return?
Yes, my older brother had a pilot's license that he got back in 1938. And he said, he told his parents at the time, he says, I'm not going to be drafted into the infantry. I don't want to be in the infantry. I want in the Air Corps. So he went to New Cumberland, Pennsylvania, and he enlisted what he thought was in the Air Corps. But what happened was instead of going into the Air Corps, he got to a tank destroyer battalion in at Fort Jackson, South Carolina. And he made an effort to get out of that place. He was in it for 2 years at Fort Jackson. One day he asked a colonel who came in to his office. He was a company clerk. And he said, I've been writing letters to get transferred to the Air Corps. I'd never hear anything. And the colonel said, well, you never will. He says, you're an enlisted man, and all they do with your letters is throw them in the wastebasket.
Oh, man.
He said, what you want to do is get your commission as a fucking lieutenant and then ask for a transfer to the Air Corps, and he says, I'll bet you'll get it. And that's what happened. He got his commission in the tank destroyers, and as soon as he got his second lieutenant, he asked for a transfer, and he got it. And he was in the Air Corps then.
Awesome. So Harold, how does that work? How can you, as an enlisted man, get to a commission? What did he have to do to make that happen?
Well, as an enlisted man, the colonel said that there's no way that they're even going to honor your request or even answer, give you an answer, as long as you are an enlisted man. He said the only way they'll talk to you is getting your commission.
And how did he get his commission? Did he have to do extra stuff, or how did he get his commission?
He got his commission in the tank destroyers, in the same outfit that he was in.
So did he just work harder than everybody?
Well, he just, I think he had to go to different camps in order to obtain that commission, but he was 2 years getting it, and it wasn't until about 1944 that he got transferred then to the Air Corps.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, you know, at this point, Harold, I mean, I think there's a real life lesson there for young people. Both of you guys thought you were going to be doing something else in the service.
Yeah.
And now that we're talking about your brother, you know...
You know, thinking back on this, as you said earlier here, that D-Day had happened on June the 6th, 1944. I was still a civilian. I didn't get drafted until July the 3rd of 1944. And I think that what had happened at D-Day with all the troops who tried to get through that invasion into Normandy, they lost so many men were killed and wounded that they probably needed more soldiers in the infantry.
Right. Yeah.
And I mean, I surmise that. I don't know that for sure, but figuring that D-Day was such a terrible, terrible, horrific invasion with a loss of manpower, that they just needed more soldiers to supply the divisions that were already in Europe.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. The losses were so significant. Harold, when Molly and I were in Normandy with these four D-Day veterans, Molly and I were kind of standing back behind two of them, Frank DeVita and Joe Shida, and they'd both been first wave Omaha with the landing crafts, operating the landing craft. And they very, very were talking very quietly with each other. And one of them said to the other, do you remember the first day the water was red? And then the other one said, yeah, it wasn't until the third day that the water was pink. And any time we've ever talked to servicemen, or service people, when they talk about Normandy, it's like those guys really, it was really rough there on Omaha Beach. So I think that your assessment is absolutely correct.
I talked to a veteran who had been in the first wave of that. And he said that the water and the waves were just red with blood going ashore on the beach. He said it was a terrible situation.
And the people of France, it's been amazing, Harold, the people of Normandy, they absolutely revere all of you guys, all of you American soldiers. Because
I have found that true. I was over there in 2016. Through the courtesy of the Greatest Generations Foundation, which
nice.
Is also has their headquarters in Denver.
Uh-huh. Yep.
And under the leadership and presidency of Timothy Davis.
Uh-huh.
And I was asked if I wanted to go over there, and I immediately said yes. In fact, they said, well, you have a brother also. I said, yes. Did you think he would want to go? I said, well, he never got into combat. He was in the Air Corps and ready to go to Japan whenever the atomic bomb was dropped, and when the second atomic bomb was dropped, his mission was canceled.
Okay.
And he never got into combat. I said, do they take non-combat soldiers? And he said, yes, they do. He said, if he served, he's a veteran, he's a World War II veteran. So my brother and I both went over in, we left the United States, I think it was on May the 30th, 2016, flew over into De Gaulle Airport in France, and we were put up at the Grand Hotel at Cobourg in Normandy.
Okay, wow. Hey, Harold, let's go to break. When we come back, we want to hear more about Normandy and Battle of the Bulge. But before that, Molly, it's football season, and it's time to tackle Hooters Restaurant's great football specials.
Yum.
They start at $10 for a draft and 10 boneless wings, $15 for a Big Daddy and sliders or bone-in wings, traditional or those new smoke ones. We love those.
Love them.
Those are half the calories. Got a group to feed, Hooters Restaurant's pitcher and nachos for only $20. So what are you waiting for, Molly? Get your game on and get into Hooters.
Absolutely. I also love the fact that it's around the holidays. You know, you're cooking and cooking for family. And some of those days you don't want to have to cook. So just call Hooters. They deliver.
That's for sure. So that's HootersColorado.com, HootersColorado.com, and let them know that you know the AmeriChicks. We'll be right back. Hey, welcome back to the AmeriChicks. Molly Vogt and Kim Munson, our World War II project. Be sure and check out our website, AmeriChicks.com. And that is where we are on Facebook and Twitter as well. All of these shows are archived there, as well as you can get these via podcast, any of those services as well. We are thrilled and honored to have on the line with us Harold Engel. He served in the 28th Infantry in the Army as a replacement, and his brother served first in,
Tank Destroyer Battalion.
Yeah. And then
in the Air Corps.
Army Air Corps. So, mm-hmm. Harold, welcome.
Harold, but also, real quick, Harold, what is your brother's name?
His name is Glenn. Two N's in Glenn.
Glenn Engel. All right.
Okay. So you and your brother Glenn go back to Normandy in 2016.
When we were there.
Yeah, we were there, too, that year. It is absolutely amazing, Harold. The people of Normandy, the celebrations, they still revere you guys. They remember they're teaching their kids in school about this. We need to be doing that in America. But
we have found, my brother and I, and the rest of the veterans who were on that journey, found that they treated us almost like rock stars.
I know.
It was awesome.
And they wanted to take pictures of us with them, and they wanted our autographs. Yes, the people of Normandy were very, very grateful and thankful for what the United States did for them.
Yeah.
Because had we not gotten into the war and liberated France, those people would be speaking German now.
Exactly. Harold, were there any stories of anything any of the locals said to you when you were there in 2016 in Normandy for the D-Day celebrations? Did any stories that anybody told you?
You mean the people who live there?
Yes, sir.
I don't recall.
Okay.
Of them doing such.
Okay. Just when we were there, our veterans, we had people walking up to them and telling them stories of their childhood and, you know, thank you for, you know, liberating this or that camp. If not for you, you know, my mother would have gone up in ashes like father did. I mean, it was very, very interesting to hear these stories. But
they would have been talking to me in French, I wouldn't have understood anyway.
right. Well, let's talk about the Battle of the Bulge, because you were a replacement.
Do you want to do that first, or do we go to his brother? Which one do you want to do first?
Well, I'm going to take you to the time that I left the United States.
Okay, let's do that.
I was taken from Camp Kilmer, New Jersey, by train to New York Harbor on Christmas Eve, December 24, 1944. I boarded a Norwegian ship that was converted to a troop ship. And on New Year's Eve, we could hear the Christmas music out on the pier. And here we were on board this ship. And we spent Christmas Day in New York Harbor, had our Christmas dinner on board the ship. Still hearing the Christmas music. But I think the reason why we were still there on Christmas Day is because they wanted to let the crew of the ship go into New York and spend Christmas in New York. And early the next morning, December the 26th, our ship pulled out of New York Harbor and, of course, went across the Atlantic. And we were about 7 days on the water, 7 or 8 days. I can't remember for sure. But we went into Liverpool, England. Never got off the ship because we got in there during daytime. But at nighttime, as soon as nightfall had happened, our ship pulled out of Liverpool and crossed the English Channel into Le Havre, France. And that's where we disembarked the ship at that point. And then when we disembarked the ship, we started walking up the streets of Le Havre to a processing center. And this was the first time that I knew that there was a war going on, because everything was bombed out at the New York, at the Le Havre Harbor. All the buildings, everything was just rubble. The bulldozers had pushed the debris off to either side of the streets in order for us to walk up to a processing center where at that time we were issued our whatever combat gear we needed. I didn't get my M1 rifle until I was at the processing center. And anything else that I would have needed. So far as ammunition and grenades or anything like that, I didn't get any of that material until I got assigned to my division, which was a couple days later, and that was about January the 4th or 5th of 1945. I joined up with the 28th Infantry Division at Colmar, France. Colmar, C-O-L-M-A-R. And that's what they call the Colmar Pocket at that time. And that's where I joined up. Now, the Battle of the Bulge, as we all know, started on December 16th, 1944. But it did not end until the end of January of 1945. So that's why I was still considered as being into the Battle of the Bulge pocket. So it was at that time then that I didn't know anybody. Being a replacement, I just didn't know anyone at all. So was
that a couple of things on that, Harold? So you get to Le Havre, France. You realize that this really is war. And as you're getting your M1 rifle and you're realizing this is combat, I mean, do you remember what went through your mind at that time?
Well, I hadn't planned for this, but that's the way it happened. And that's when you get the feeling that, it's probably not going to be too long before you're going to be engaging the enemy in some way, shape, or form. So you had to be thinking about it, but it was winter time. There was snow on the ground, and I can remember being transported on the back of a truck. There was about a dozen of us in the truck, and it was snowing when we got to our division at Colmar.
So, and when you got there, is it Colmar or Colbar? Colmar?
Colmar. C-O-L-M-A-R.
Okay, got it. So, Harold, when you got there, many of the guys, I mean, they've been through the battle for a while, and here you're kind of coming in as a replacement, kind of green.
Yeah, a lot of those guys were in the battle, battles before I got there, and they had lost a good many of their division, either by being killed, captured, or wounded. And in fact, the Battle of the Bulge got so bad that the division band is usually back at division headquarters. But they had to tell the band, pack up your instruments and pick up your carbines.
Really?
You're going to have to go out and fight. And they lost some of the band members through the Battle of the Bulge at that time.
Wow.
I mean, I guess a lot of those band members never felt that they were going to be going up to the front.
Right.
And being part of the battle, but they had to fight for their own lives at that time.
Yeah.
So it was pretty bad.
Mm. So Harold Engel, we're talking with Harold. He was served in World War II. We're talking about you're getting to the Battle of the Bulge and you're part of the replacements. What is it that you first saw on the battlefield?
Well, I wasn't with the division more than about 2 days. And our platoon, the platoon I was in, was assigned to go on a mission to take out a machine gun nest that was up in the Vosges Mountains. Vosges is spelled V-O-S-G-E-S. V as in Victor, V-O-S-G-E-S Mountains, which these mountains were close to Colmar. So around 8 o'clock one night, about the second night after I was there, we loaded onto trucks. There was a platoon. We had two trucks that took us to the foot of these mountains. And we got off the truck. It was snowing the ground, and it was even snowing a little bit. And we head up a trail that happened to be a trail that went up the mountain. And probably that was probably a mistake that we should not have done, going up this trail, because we didn't get too far up the trail until the sergeant who was the head of our column, he tripped a wire that had been laid under the snow so that when the troops went up this, anybody would cross, go up this trail, they would trip this wire, and as soon as that wire was tripped, then flares would go up into the sky and light the whole mountainside, and that's exactly what happened.
Mm.
The flares went off, lit the whole mountainside, and as soon as those flares went off, the Germans started to zero in on the trail that we were going up because they knew where they laid the wire. And fortunately, we were in sort of a depression in the ground where the ground was a little higher and we were down below it. So we actually were pinned down from about 8 o'clock at night until the next morning. They were continually at on and off firing their machine gun at us until finally our commanding officer said, there's no use to try to go up this way, to go up to the mountain to where they are. He said, we're going to retreat back down the mountain and try to come up behind them and get them from the back. So we went back down the mountain and started to come up another way of that mountain. And I was a second scout. There was a first scout, a second scout. The first scout, he was covering the right flank while we were walking through the mountain. I was covering the left flank while walking through the mountain. We all had white hoods pulled down over us to camouflage us in the snow. And, of course, you know, the scouts are always out a little further than the rest of the platoon. I never knew why I was appointed the second scout.
Oh, boy.
I think it was because of the old-timers that were in the division. They knew that if there's going to be any fire, the second scouts, the first and second scouts, going to get it. And but I was not aware of that at the time. And later, there was an officer told me. He said, "Well, that's the reason why you were made a scout." He said, "They know what it's like to be a scout." So anyway, I'm walking through the mountain, and off in the distance, to my left, on my left flank, I noticed some other soldiers that are walking towards me. And they had white hoods pulled down over them. So at the time, I didn't know whether they were friend or foe. So as they got a little closer, one of the Germans didn't have his hood pulled down over his helmet completely. And I was able to see that distinctive German helmet. As soon as I saw that, I motioned everybody behind me, down, get down. Well, they noticed us too at the same time. So we all hit the ground. They hit the ground, we hit the ground, and we start to exchange fire with each other. I'm firing away with my M1 rifle. They had automatic weapons. They had what we called burp guns. It sent out a volley of bullets all at one time. And they used like magazines of bullets were attached to their automatic weapon. But anyways, while I was in the prone position, firing away, one of the German bullets came in and hit me on the brim of my steel helmet. That bullet went past my ear. I had a wool-knit cap pulled down over my ears, but that bullet, when it hit the steel helmet, went past my ear, tore that wool-knit cap all to shreds. There was only a couple of threads hanging there, and the bullet went into my right shoulder. So I was hurting a little bit. I didn't know how bad at the time. But anyways, kept firing away. When that bullet hit my steel helmet, the velocity of that bullet hitting the helmet caused me to black out momentarily. I just literally was out of it for a few moments, and I couldn't do anything. But when I came to, I started firing again, and not long after that, one of the Germans threw a grenade over at me because I was the closest one to them. And I could see this grenade coming. I looked up in the air and saw this grenade coming. There was nothing I could do. If I stood up, I was going to be shot. And all I did was I just laid in the prone position, covered my head with my arms, and I said a quick prayer, a pop-up prayer. I said, God, protect me. That grenade landed within 3 feet of me, and it was a dud.
Oh, wow. My gosh. Oof. Oh, my gosh.
What never went off.
Ugh.
Now, I...
Hey, you know what, Harold? Let's hold on. Let's go to Harold.
Did you get that?
No. No, what did you just say?
I did not pick up that grenade for a souvenir.
Yeah, it's all right. It stuck with you, I'm sure.
Hey, Harold. Let's go to break. We'll be right back. We want to hear more. This is absolutely fascinating. This is the AmeriChicks, Molly Vogt and Kim Munson. We are talking with World War II veteran Harold Engel, and we will be right back.
Welcome back to the AmeriChicks World War II Project with Molly and Kim. Check out all of our shows on AmeriChicks.com. We've got all of our former World War II shows. We're excited. We've interviewed over 100 World War II veterans, and every single story is different. Right now, we're on the phone with Harold Engel. He served in the 28th Infantry Division. He was a replacement in the Battle of the Bulge. And Harold, his older brother, also served as well, Glenn Engel. And so, Harold, before we went to break, you were talking about the fact that you were going up the Vosges Mountains?
Yes.
Vosges Mountains.
The Vosges Mountains.
Okay. And so you're going up. One of the guys trips the wire on the way up the mountains. Flares went off. The Germans can see you. The lights are everywhere. They're zeroing in on you. You're hiding through the night. A quick question on that, though. You're trying to hide through the night, but they can see you because of the flares. How are you hiding? Are you behind trees? Did you dig foxholes in the snow? I mean, how did you make it through that first night?
Well, the flares only lasted for a while. I mean, they only sent up one set of flares, and those flares don't last that long. And then it becomes dark.
Okay.
And like I said, there was a depression in the ground where when they were firing, these bullets were actually going over our head. We were in a prone position laying in the snow. But there was a bank that we were protected by that we could get low enough that we wouldn't be hit. But like I said, being pinned down, yeah. they didn't fire consistently all night, just off and on.
Okay.
They were firing away. But they were firing in the direction of the trail that they knew we were on.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was nothing for us to do but go back down the mountain and come up another way.
Right. And so when you did that and you went back up the other way, you did get into, you were on the ground, you're exchanging fire back and forth with the Germans. They've got automatic weapons. You've got your M1. You got hit on the steel helmet. It tore your cap to shreds, bullet in your right shoulder, blacked out for a few minutes, started firing again, and a German throws a grenade at you, and you see it coming. And you got to be thinking, this is it. This is the end. You said a prayer to God to protect you, and he did.
And he
it
did.
Was a dud.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes. No doubt. but, you know, when we were firing away, our commanding officer said that he wanted us to form a skirmish line across the forest. This is a straight line across the forest. And he said, when I give the order, I want everybody to get up and start firing, and I don't care. It doesn't matter if you see anything or not. Just keep firing away. Because he says, as long as you're firing and the bullets are flying at them, they're going to keep down. But he said, before we do that, I'm going to ask for some mortar fire from our fellows behind to lob some mortars in the area where we think they are. And that's what they did. They put some mortars up in that area. I happened to have a grenade myself that I could fire from my M1 rifle. It was a rifle grenade. And I only had one. So I put my launcher on the end of the barrel of my M1 rifle, and I had one blank, to put in the chamber. And I put this grenade over the launcher, and since my shoulder was hurting, I couldn't fire it from my shoulder. I had to put the butt end of the rifle down into the ground and point it towards where I thought the Germans were. And, you know, through all the excitement and the chaos at the time, I can't remember whether I pulled the pin on that grenade before I fired it. If I did not pull the pin, it was going to be a dud, just like the one that was fired at me. And so I don't know whether my grenade went off. I don't remember at all. But whenever the commanding officer said to form this skirmish line and fire for all you're worth, some of the fellows who were walking said they saw two dead Germans as they were walking towards them. And so apparently they were either hit by our rifle fire, or they were hit by mortar fire or some other way. I don't know whether my grenade went off or not. I can't remember to this day whether I pulled that pin.
No, I imagine there's a lot of action at that time for sure. So, Harold, were you involved in other battles as well, or skirmishes?
Yes, we were. We had crossed the Rhine River, and we got into Germany, and we were at a small town called Hallenthal, just a small village. But just outside of this village was a large hill. It was a very large hill, and the Germans had occupied it before we got there. They had dug a trench all the way around this hill. And eventually they were taken over by another division, not our division. And then we were supposed to go in and relieve the other division and occupy the trenches. And while we occupied the trenches down in the valley, they had a tank down there that was firing 88 millimeter shells at us. They were also firing off mortars, and they had artillery they were firing at us in these open trenches. And fortunately, none of them became close to where I was. But some of our fellows got wounded as a result of either the mortar fire or the artillery fire. And so this is the eerie part of the story. The medics, you know, they had big red crosses on their front and on the back. They hunched down and walked on top of the trenches in front of us to get the wounded out. And the Germans saw them. And apparently there was a German officer that had a little compassion. because I don't think an enlisted man would have made the decision to do what he did. He apparently told them not to fire any more artillery and no more mortars until they get the wounded out. And they didn't. They didn't fire anything. Everything was quiet. And they got the wounded out as soon as they saw that the medics were gone. Then they started up again. So I have to give that German officer some credit for making that decision to have the compassion to not fire at us while those medics were taking the wounded out.
Right. Wow.
So that's why I say it was sort of an eerie situation. There's another thing about those mortars that they fired. When they came down, you didn't know where they were going to land, but they screamed like a woman with a high-pitched voice, screaming. And we called them, we didn't call them mortars, we called them screaming Mimis. Screaming Mimis. They lobbed a lot of those into the area where our forces were, but eventually then we were relieved by another division, and we were pulled out, and that was the end of that battle.
And where did you go from there, Harold? Then,
well, we were sort of in an occupation mood. We were, certain towns were liberated, particular company or battalion would maybe be billeted in some of those small towns. We weren't always up at the front because what had happened before anybody crossed the Rhine River, there were eight of us, and they all came from the platoon that I was in. We were training to go across the Rhine River because no one had crossed the Rhine River up to this point. So we trained back on a lake in France area, and on rubber rafts, and we were ready to go on this mission to go in these rubber rafts across the Rhine River. There were four of us in one raft. We pulled a spare raft behind us. There's just eight of us, but there was two small islands out in the middle of the Rhine River, which they didn't know whether there was any Germans on them or not. And we were supposed to go on these rubber rafts and go onto those islands to see if there were any Germans on the islands themselves. And if not, they could maybe use it as a jumping off point for other troops to go across the Rhine River. But fortunately, we didn't have to go on that mission because General George Patton and his battalion of tanks crossed the Rhine River and they penetrated pretty deep into Germany. But of course, as you know, the tanks are penetrating as they go, but there has to be, the infantry has to take care of the flanks on either side.
Right.
I mean, just because you burst through doesn't say that you won the battle. The infantry has to go in and take care of whatever's to the right or to the left. And so that's basically what we did. but never had to do it for long because we were always relieved by another division.
Okay. Well, Harold Engel, we are just out of time. This has gone way too quickly. So interesting. One quick question. When you see the American flag these days, what goes through your mind?
Well, if it's in a parade, depending on where it is, I mean, I salute it. I don't kneel like a lot of the NFL players were doing. Now, I respect the flag, and I think everybody should do that. We live in a free country, and it's because of our military might that we're able to be free. And so a lot of things happen that you either like or you don't like. And the thing that I don't like is to see somebody that doesn't respect our flag.
Yeah. Well, Harold Engel, thank you so much. We agree. When Molly and I came back from Normandy, we totally respected the flag, respected the military, but it was a whole new appreciation for what has happened. And we stand on the shoulders of giants, whether or not it was Washington and the Revolutionary War, Civil War, or you guys, World War II, all the other wars. We stand on the shoulders of giants. We have a freedom to preserve here, and we are just ever so grateful. So, Harold Engel, thank you so much for joining the AmeriChicks today. We are just thrilled to have this interview with you.
Thank you, Harold. God bless you.
I thank you, too.
All right. Well, this is the AmeriChicks, Molly and Kim, and our World War II project. If you have a World War II story, we'd love to hear it. Please reach out to us at AmeriChicks.com, and you can get all of our former shows there as well. Have a great day, and we'll talk to you next Sunday here on Easy 1430.
Join us next time for the World War II project and your hosts, the AmeriChicks, Molly Vogt and Kim Munson. Until then, keep saluting the greatest generation.